Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. Quickly swipe up if you're on iOS, and I guess it's on Android like that as well. Swipe up from the bottom and you could do a little quick multitask over to Instagram and follow me up at the username at Kevin Rose on Instagram. I'd appreciate it. Today, my guest is Sam Harris, and Sam is an extremely well-known podcast host. He created the podcast called Waking Up. It has since been renamed to the Making Sense podcast. It's one of my favorites in rotation. I listen to almost every episode. He's a great host. He's also an author, really well-known author, New York Times best-selling author several times over. And he has created books like The End of Faith and Waking Up, Free Will, and then also a book called Lying. Lying, I got to tell you, it's awesome. It's all about the white lies that we tell to other people and why we should avoid doing that. And we should be direct and transparent with people. And he really puts forward a great argument for doing that. Highly recommend if you have an Audible credit and you end up liking this interview. And Sam, download the book Lying. I think you'll really enjoy it. It was one of my favorites. Today, though, we're covering and talking about his meditation app, Waking Up. And the reason I wanted to have Sam on is because I just finished doing his 50-day introduction course, and I thought it was one of the best courses on meditation that I've ever taken. And I've done a lot of formal meditation training. I used to live across the street from the Zen Center, the San Francisco Zen Center. I was very lucky in that I just ended up buying a place that was like five doors down from that on Page Street in San Francisco. And I would walk to the Zen Center and I could listen to Dharma talks. I could go and do Zazen and sit. And so I really got into meditation pretty early on. Then apps started coming out, got into Headspace, got into Calm. And I realized that the one thing that was lacking from these apps is that they were very prescriptive in nature, meaning that you would come in and they had a pack for pretty much everything, like a package of different meditations. So if you had a fear of flying or you had some anxiety or you were dealing with a difficult breakup, these types of apps would have a series of guided meditations that would bring you relief, which I think is a great thing and certainly something that needs to exist. I created a meditation app called Oak, which was trying to fill some of the gaps that I thought weren't really out there. So we had a course on mantra-based meditation, which there isn't really anything out there in the app store. So we launched that. We did an unguided timer, which is a really high-quality unguided timer that we launched for people that already had an existing practice. So for example, you know, if you went to Zen meditation and you wanted to sit at home, you could just launch our unguided timer and use pretty much any discipline that you wanted and just use it for a timer. So very simple app. But what I was looking for was an app that would go deep in a discipline and was a serious app for people that didn't want to do this just once a week or twice a week or use it in times of emergency, which I feel in my conversations with other people that use meditation apps, they'll say, oh, I'm really stressed, so I decided to meditate today. Hey, I haven't done it in a month, but you know, it helped me out. And I think there's obviously value in that. But what about those of us that want to develop a real regular practice and want to be guided on how we can take this to the next level and go even deeper within ourselves and figure out what's going on in our heads? And Sam is the perfect kind of host and guide to take us through not a 10-day course, but a 50-day course on the basics of Vipassana-style meditation. And I thought it was fantastic. The app has a bunch of lessons as well. I talked to Sam and he has agreed to include one of my favorite lessons at the end of this podcast. So stick around for that. It's 7 minutes of Sam speaking to you. I don't want to ruin it, but I think you're really going to enjoy this lesson. It's a lesson in mindfulness that is unlike any that I have heard before, and it will definitely give you a different perspective on moment to moment in everyday life and give you a little taste of what some of his lessons are like. So this is normally a paid thing, but it's going to be completely free here at the end of this podcast. So definitely, yeah, I mean, even if you're like halfway through the podcast and you're like, I just can't, I don't have time for this or whatever, skip to the end and do this 7-minute course from Sam. I promise you it's awesome and you're going to really like it. So don't skip that. We're going to dive in now and talk to Sam and really get into the ins and outs of taking meditation seriously.
Well, thanks for agreeing to do this. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Happy to do it.
Excited to, I just had Tim Ferriss over at my house last couple of days. He came out to visit and we did a podcast together and we brought up your meditation app and talked about how we both love it. So
cool. Yeah. He's been super supportive. It's great. I'm glad you're finding it useful. It's really, I'm, as you know, a reluctant entrepreneur who's been getting a very expensive business education. But it's all working now. So it was a kind of a long road to get here.
That's great. I wanted to start off actually, I think a great place to start off the podcast would be just to get your background. Cause I think a lot of people come to you, through different avenues. And I know for me, it was, not through your books initially. I had since gone back and just recently downloaded, Waking Up. But it was a podcast that I first learned about, you know, your whole platform and the stuff that the content you produce. But I'd love to hear, you know, when you got into meditation, like how long ago was that and what led you to a practice?
I kind of got into all of my interests in what I consider to be the backwards order. I mean, I got into meditation first, and this was now over 30 years ago. I mean, I guess this isn't backwards. I had some experiences with psychedelics, which led to an interest in just the nature of mind and what could be understood about it in a first person way through introspection. And that naturally led me to meditation. And, you know, I was into writing at this point, and now I'm about, 18, but I thought I was just going to write fiction. And so I wound up dropping out of school because, really, I didn't see the necessity of finishing. I didn't see the necessity of going to graduate school because I was just going to write novels and study meditation. And I got very into meditation at that point and spent a lot of time on retreat. And I studied with various teachers in India and Nepal, and that really absorbed much of my 20s. But my writing changed to nonfiction, and because I was reading a lot of philosophy and science and wanted to write about the nature of mind. But the moment I transitioned to nonfiction, it became just glaringly obvious that it now mattered that I had not completed my education. So I decided to go back to school and wound up doing my PhD in neuroscience, which I always entered that program very much in a philosophical frame of mind. I mean, I was a philosopher of mind, or, an aspiring philosopher of mind who just wanted to get his arms around the scientific details as we were coming to know them from neuroscience. So, I thought I was going to do a PhD in philosophy, but then, at the last minute decided neuroscience made more sense. So, in the middle of my neuroscience PhD, or, the first 2 years of it, when September 11th happened, and so, here I was, someone who is now, 34, and had spent the better part of a decade, more than a decade, studying religion and philosophy on my own, and was now doing research, fMRI research on the nature of belief, belief, in any form of propositional knowledge, whether it's, factual or semantic or autobiographical or in fact religious. So I was thinking about religious faith and its consequences, and had spent at least a decade pursuing my own contemplative experiences, but both on retreat and with psychedelics. And so I understood what the core experiences were that had given rise to our religious traditions. And now people started flying planes into our buildings based on specific religious ideas that most rational people should find fairly incredible. And I just observed in the aftermath of that because of our attachment to our own religious mythology, we had no way of talking about what was happening apart from just doubling down on our own religious tribalism.
Right.
And it seemed absolutely perverse to me. So my first book, The End of Faith, was very much a culture war book where I paint a very stark opposition between reason and faith and science and religion. And, this kind of brought me into prominence among atheists, among whom I had never really positioned myself. I hadn't thought of myself as an atheist. I'd never used the word. I had never visited an atheist website, much less gone to an atheist conference.
Did you have any religious beliefs when you were younger at all? Was that ever in your household or no?
No. I mean, I had a very strong interest in, quote, spiritual experience once I turned around, 18 or so. And that was based on some initial experiences with MDMA. And, then once I started sitting in meditation retreats and studying in India and Nepal, then it became an explicit interest in altered states of consciousness and Eastern philosophy and you know, all those related topics. And religion generally, but just not faith-based religion. I was just interested in the contemplative teachings in each religious tradition, East and West. So then this kind of moment of public criticism of religion and, kind of fairly militant atheism sort of sidelined my scientific research for a few years. I then wrote another book, Letter to a Christian Nation, which was the response to the Christian pushback to the end of faith. And I mean, all the while, I was still talking about meditation. I mean, there's at least one chapter on the nature of mind and contemplative experience in my first book, but still it all got overshadowed by my very uncompromising criticism of religious faith. And so, atheism was kind of the first framing under which I became public and anyone would have noticed me. But then I wrote, several other books that, where it was not about atheism. The next book, The Moral Landscape, was how we can understand morality and values in a rational scientific framework. And that was actually an edited version of what was my PhD dissertation for UCLA. So, and then I've written a book on the ethics of lying.
I love that book, by the way. I thought that was great.
Oh, cool.
That was a pretty short little book, right? If I recall.
Yeah. I'm now a fan of short books, both as a reader and a writer. I noticed that, everyone has the same bandwidth problem I have, which is there's an infinite amount of stuff to read and, it's just so much is competing for your attention now. And so if you write a long book, it's a very common experience to, especially if it's an argument-driven book that's controversial, you often see people reacting to it where it's clear that they haven't read the whole book. I mean, they read the first chapter, they read your last chapter, they poked around in it, and then they are slamming you for not saying things that you did in fact say in the book. And so all that becomes more and more frustrating. So I now like to write books that are so short that if someone starts them, there's a good chance they're going to finish them.
Yeah, there was you caused an internal debate amongst my family. I had brought up the idea of not telling our daughters there's a Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. And you covered that in the book as right. Well. Yeah. And that was just like, my family is very traditional. My wife and I are on board with that. But, I definitely, my mom and sister were a little appalled by such ideas. But yeah, it was a fun read for sure.
Yeah, it's amazing. That's the most common question when you draw a very firm prohibition against lying. The first question you get is really only two questions. It's, what do you say when she asks, "Do I look fat in this dress?" And what do you say about Santa Claus? That's basically what people are worried about in the 21st century.
Yeah. How do you, I'm curious just to dig into that book a little bit. Cause we never had chatted about it offline when we've hung out a couple of times. So I'm really curious to know, how do you embrace those principles with your spouse? Like how do you, is something that might be charged, do you try and land it a certain way? Like there's a fine line between being just kind of brutally honest and also being just like a dick. Like how can you make sure that something lands the right way if you are being honest?
Yeah, well, there's the background fact that you're on the same team, right? I mean, you really do love your spouse. And you want what's best for them. And insofar as you think you can see what's best for them, you're honestly articulating that is never going to be a bad thing. I mean, you can be wrong, right? And you certainly can admit that you might be wrong. If anything really matters, presumably they actually want to see the world as you see it. And so it's never really a matter of being tempted to lie. I mean, obviously there are better and worse ways to communicate what's true, and it can be challenging to figure out exactly what is true. I mean, the truth might be just that you have a preference for something and you're not sure how that really maps onto the world, right? Like, you know, you think one thing looks better than another, but you know that you're not going to say that all of humanity would agree with you, right? Mm-hmm. So you can kind of finesse it, which is to say, you just, you know, be more and more scrupulous about what you really think is true in these situations. But part of it is also, I mean, you know, so if you realize that that's the context where you might be delivering any kind of awkward truth to someone, it softens it a lot. But I mean, the reality is that there are certain people who just don't want the truth, right? I mean, like, right. You know, they'll hand you something for feedback, and all they really want is to be told it's great. And when you demur at all from that line, you're offending them. And what happens is you just wind up training these people that you're not the person to come to when they want to be bullshitted, right? And that's great. I mean, then you no longer have to deal with that in your life. And people really, and the moment to notice, which is really great, is when you have given someone, you know, truly honest feedback that is critical, and they, you know, they receive it, and they you know, presumably find it useful, and they absorb it. It's not what they wanted to hear, but it is what you truly had to say. Then on some other occasion, when they give you something that you actually really love and your feedback is fundamentally different, at that moment, they just know you're being honest, right? They know you're not bullshitting. And that's so valuable. I mean, the people are so grateful and as someone who receives critical feedback myself, it's such a relief to recognize those moments when you're in the presence of someone who is telling you to your face exactly what they would be saying behind your back to somebody mm-hmm. else that they respected. And, you know, that you really want to bring those two sides of your life into close register, and you want to be around people who are doing likewise. I mean, you want friends who speak about you in your absence exactly the way they would speak if you were sitting at the table. And we all know what it's like when, you know, those awkward moments where you're at a group dinner and someone gets up to go to the bathroom, and then, you know, then people start dishing about them, and then they come back and the conversation changes. And what's interesting to notice about that is not only does that say something about your relationship to that person, you've actually communicated something to everyone else at the table.
Sure.
Because everyone else at the table knows that you're likely to be dishing about them when they get up to go to the bathroom. And it reduces trust kind of everywhere all at once. And it's very insidious.
That's a great point. And also, you know, it's how we learn to get that honest feedback and improve as individuals. I know one thing that I did that was really useful a couple of years ago was this idea of 360 feedback. It's a popular mm-hmm. thing in like the corporate world, but I did it on a personal level where I had 10 of my friends, a mixture of just friends only and then friends/colleagues. And I had them, they were interviewed by this coach, and it was completely anonymous. And then the feedback was presented back to me in aggregate, so I wouldn't know who was saying what. Mm-hmm. And it was shocking. I mean, there was definitely some big ahas in there where I'm like, wow, I really wish I would have had this. I would have this conversation directly with my friends. But I found it very useful because sometimes there's people that just don't, you know, they don't know how to go about this in giving direct yeah. feedback, and people tend to dodge and soften things. And, but I'm one of those people, I'm sure like you are, that just would rather have the real honest, straight talk, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's fascinating. I've never done that, but I have a friend, do you know Dan Harris, who's got the 10% happier
yes.
app in the book? Yeah. So yeah, he did that. I think he just did that in a professional context, but he had like all of his colleagues hit him with 360 feedback, and he was reeling from it. It was quite an intense experience. He talks about it a bunch on his podcast.
Yeah, it's definitely useful. So I'm jumping back a little bit though. I wanted to know, what was the first discipline of meditation that you studied, and did that change over time?
Yeah, well, I got into Vipassana practice first, and that is the Vipassana is the Pali word for insight practice, and it comes from the oldest tradition of Buddhism, the Theravada, and it is the source of what we generally speak of as mindfulness in the West, which is the type of attention you're training in Vipassana so as to produce what's called insight is mindfulness. And so I spent a lot of time doing that with some very great Western teachers who were among the first people to popularize mindfulness in the West, people like Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield. And then I went and studied with some of their teachers, mainly the Burmese meditation master, Upandita Sayadaw. But eventually, after maybe spending about a cumulative year on retreat, I was sitting like 1 month to 3 month retreats, and anything from 1 weekend to 3 months, but mostly it was kind of longer chunks. And once I had gotten to about a year of that, I got more and more frustrated in my practice. I mean, there was kind of a logic of the Burmese style of mindfulness practice where it really was goal oriented, where as much as you're trying to just be in the present moment and really in fact are just landing in the present moment and accepting whatever your experience is like there, there was an explicit logic to the practice, which was seeking to get to some state which was not currently present for you. And that logic became more and more frustrating, and ultimately just it was at odds with what I was gleaning was true from studying other traditions and just from just thinking about how consciousness must be. I mean, there just must be some way to recognize that consciousness is already free of the self. For instance, it's not that you have a self and then you get rid of it through meditation. It's actually it's an illusion, and presumably that you can cut through that illusion directly, and you don't have to schlep up to the top of the mountaintop to do it. You can do it right here at the mountain's base. And so I started seeking out some other styles of practice after that, and that was an important difference. But I still think that Vipassana is the best introductory practice for anybody, because it's unlike mantra practice or any visualization practice. There's nothing that you're strategically adding to your experience. You're just paying attention to the next breath, the next sound, the next thought, whatever's arising. And so there's no layer of religiosity or iconography or any any cultural trappings that you have to embrace or think about or reason yourself into. It's just pay clear, non-judgmental attention to experience. So I think this is the best place to start, certainly for secular, rational people who don't want to take on a new set of religious ideas.
Yeah. When you were doing these, you said up to 3 months, these retreats, were these silent retreats, or what does a 3 month retreat look like? Like, can you describe an average day?
Yeah. So it's a very formalized, especially if you do it at someplace like the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, which is, both IMS and Spirit Rock. Spirit Rock, I don't think, has a 3 month retreat, but they have the same kinds of retreats. Whether it's 1 week or 3 months, it's the same kind of schedule where you're sitting and walking by turns. So there's a sitting practice and a walking practice, and you're just alternating hour by hour throughout the day. And once you're into it, after a few days, you're really just, the goal is to continuously practice mindfulness and to really not not respect any boundary between the sitting and the walking and every other moment in the day. So you're trying to be as mindful as possible at lunch and when you're drinking a cup of tea and when you're getting ready for bed. And so you're just linking all of these moments together in silence. You don't talk to anyone else on the retreat. I mean, there might be a hundred people on retreat with you, but you're not talking and you're not even making eye contact. And it's amazing how you can just function in a common space with 100 other people really perfectly. I mean, there's nothing awkward about it. There's nothing, you can literally go 3 months without making eye contact with another human being and yet be navigating a common space with them all the while, because, you know, all the meals are just a buffet. I mean, there's nothing, you never have to ask someone to pass the salt, or, I mean, they've created a kind of, you know, machine for contemplation there, where it's just, you're completely taken care of. It's very intimate too, to be in silence with other people. It's quite a beautiful experience. And then each night there's a lecture, you know, called a Dharma talk, Dharma being the word for the teachings and also for the reality that one is uncovering. I mean, it's translated as the way or the truth or the teachings, depending on the context. So you'll have a lecture about the practice each night, and you'll have usually every other day or so, depending on the retreat, and a very brief interview with a teacher just to check in.
And that's the only time you can talk, right? Is when you're one-on-one interviews.
Yeah. So for like 10 minutes, you'll talk to somebody. I mean, I've done some retreats where I decided I didn't need interviews with teachers. And so I was actually didn't talk to anyone for 3 months, but generally speaking, at least in a Vipassana context, you would have a periodic interview and just to kind of fine tune the practice and to make sure you're not going crazy. I mean, it helps to certainly in the beginning to get, you know, all the guidance you can get.
Yeah, I'm curious when you go to one of these. I have not done one yet. My wife's done a 10-day silent retreat, and she loved it. When someone is kind of getting to or beginning a new practice, and I think you do this really quite well with your app. I just finished day 50 today. Actually, I timed it so that would be today, and it's such great content.
Well done.
But, you know, I think most people, when they think about meditation, they think about it in that they have either heard about it or they have gone in and tried, you know, one of the popular apps that are out there. They've probably sat for a couple sessions, and it's still at that point like, oh, I use it for relaxation, you know, or I use it for, it's prescriptive in a way. So I have a fear of flying, so I take my fear of flying pack today, you know. When you're taking it seriously, meaning that you really want to develop a deep practice here, other than just the technique of, you know, kind of following the breath, what do people learn in terms of what the self is and what is consciousness? Can you go into that a little bit? Like, how would you instruct someone if they wanted to learn about those things and what a deeper practice looks like?
Yeah, well, yeah. So this is something I'm really trying to do in my app. And so I start with a fairly standard mindfulness curriculum. But as you know, if you got to day 50, you know, somewhere around day 20 or so, it becomes kind of non-standard and non-dualistic. And I guess I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment. There are two pieces to this. One is that you ultimately recognize that meditation isn't something you're doing. It's not actually a practice. It's when you're actually practicing, you're ceasing to do something that you're always tending to do. And that thing is identify with each passing thought. So thoughts arise and you don't notice them as appearances in consciousness, and they seem to become you, right? They completely subsume your point of view. And that the feeling of being a self, the feeling of being a subject behind your face, the feeling of being an I or a me, the feeling of being a thinker of thoughts, who is kind of the author of your intentions and your moment to moment experience. All of that is what it feels like to be identified with thought helplessly in each moment. And meditation, I mean, real meditation, you know, meditation, I mean, there are many different things that go by the name of meditation, but the meditation that I'm talking about is a recognition that consciousness prior to identification with thought doesn't feel like a self. It doesn't feel like a subject in the head. It doesn't feel like there's someone behind your face looking out. It doesn't feel like there's a thinker in addition to the arising of thought. And when you recognize that and can become aware of that as your practice, that then practice is no longer a something. It's no longer a technique you're applying strategically. It's no longer something you're doing. It's, again, in each moment, something you're recognizing, and that recognition is made possible because there's something you're no longer doing, which is becoming lost in thought. And, you know, and there's kind of an energetics to this, which is, you know, to be identified with thought is this analogy to kind of having a clenched fist. I mean, you're sort of contracted and recoiling from experience. I mean, you're trying to appropriate experience. You're grasping at what's pleasant. You're trying to push away what's unpleasant. You're reacting to everything. And I mean, you can get a sense of this when you imagine what it's like to become acutely self-conscious, right? Like imagine you walk into a room and you feel like everyone's looking at you, or you know, something awkward just happened, or you just embarrassed yourself, and that feeling of sort of projecting your eyes outward and having everyone's, you know, following everyone's gaze back to where you think you are, that feeling of heightened self-consciousness, that cramp is really kind of always present in this feeling we call ourselves. And we take this into relationship, and and this is the thing that we try to, we're happy to feel it relax when we're having a very pleasant peak experience, or when we're kind of in a flow state, when we're working out, or even just watching a movie. I mean, one of the reasons why watching films or television is so relaxing is that it is an experience of a kind of loss of self. I mean, you sort of forget yourself. You certainly forget you're sitting in a theater looking at light on the wall, and you become absorbed in this other thing. And we seek this experience out, and meditation is a way of recognizing that consciousness prior to identification with thought is simply that way. I mean, you can enjoy it directly without having to arrange anything about the world or about your behavior to access it. And so that's,
I was curious, would you say, when I think about this, I'm always trying to think in certain analogies that I can wrap my brain around, because it's hard to unpack a lot of this stuff. I often think about, since it's probably because I'm a technologist and built computers when I was younger, but I think of it as a functioning computer that is working, but with no like applications installed. So it's just like a base. And I feel like in correct me where I'm wrong here, but I feel like when there's certain things that get installed into us all throughout life, meaning our belief systems, ways that, you know, someone might have cheated on us when we were in a relationship, when we were younger, all these little things that occur, that then when new information comes in, if they hit one of these things, they cause a whole chain of different events. You know, it's like the difference between enjoying a cup of coffee that's single origin, that's amazing, that you love, and handing that same cup of coffee to someone that's Mormon, that doesn't drink coffee, and all of a sudden sees it as a sin. And like, they're going to have a completely different experience than the coffee lover, right? And that's all because of programming and programs that are kind of like launched inside of the brain and that are stuck there. Would you say that consciousness, it is happening and unfolding in the brain, and it is the fact that the brain is booted up and running. Is that kind of correct?
Well, so we can talk about this from the first person side or the third person side, and I think they require a different way of speaking. So from the third person side, so talking about, you know, brains out there in the world, there's every reason to believe that consciousness is arising at some level based on the information processing that's happening in our brains, right? I mean, you're certainly on firm ground if you think that that's so, although the truth is we don't actually know that that's the case. I mean, it's quite possible that something spookier is in fact true. I mean, it's possible that consciousness is a more fundamental property of matter than that, and you know, maybe even individual neurons or even, you know, even subatomic particles could have a kind of interior subjectivity that we just are not able to inspect.
Well, in that case, a rock could be conscious at that point if something that spooky is true.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there's a name for this view. in philosophy is called panpsychism. And there's no, it might be an unfalsifiable view. I mean, I wouldn't expect rocks to start talking to us if you know, electrons were conscious. But it's just to say that if you're going to be scrupulous about this, you know, it's only fair to admit that we don't actually know how consciousness is integrated with the physics of things. We don't know at what level it arises, and therefore we don't know how far down it goes in the phylogenetic tree. We don't know if crickets are conscious. It's, you know, anybody's guess whether a cricket brain is sufficient for, you know, the lights to come on. And for this reason, we don't yet know what would make our computers conscious. And so if we ever build computers that pass the Turing test and seem conscious to us, you know, they seem, you know, certainly if we build super intelligent robots that we can talk to, they're going to seem conscious. I mean, especially if we give them faces and if we make them at all humanoid and, you know, that we give them emotions that make us comfortable with them, and they become better detectors of our own emotions than even our closest friends, we will be massively persuaded that we're in relationship to beings that have their own point of view. But until we understand how consciousness actually emerges, we won't know that that's the case. And that's just an interesting intellectual and ultimately ethical problem, because if we're building machines that are conscious, well, then we're building machines that can suffer, you know, and then it's reasonable to worry that, you know, when you recycle your iPhone 75, are you actually committing a murder, you know, if your iPhone was conscious? So it's, you know, it's not, I mean, these can seem like academic ideas and debates, but the reality is that every ethical question turns on whether or not some conscious agent can be affected by a set of facts. And, you know, so, you know, not understanding how consciousness emerges is a problem, you know, as we move into a plausible future where we'll be simulating worlds on computers, right? I mean, if we're building simulated minds that can suffer, you know, and we could be inadvertently, you know, creating hells and populating them. And it seems that would be obviously a terrible thing to do. And if consciousness really is at bottom just a matter of information processing, which is a totally respectable thing to think, then this is absolutely something we might wind up doing. I mean, to doubt that we might do it is really at bottom to doubt that consciousness is just a matter of information processing. You know, there are reasons to wonder whether or not it is, but it certainly might be. And so anyway, that's all just to talk about the world and brains and the world. But from the point of view of the world, there is no evidence of consciousness anywhere, right? If you look at a brain, there's no evidence that it's conscious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, likewise with any computer system we would build, you know, no matter how it behaves, if you look at its internal states, or even its behavior. I mean, there's no behavior that necessarily advertises that, you know, consciousness had to be associated with it.
It sounds like we don't have a good definition. That's part of the problem, right? It's not really definable.
Well, it's not definable by reference to its external properties. Right. It's only definable. It's only conceivable, I would argue, from the first person side, which is, you know, what we experience directly in ourselves, in and as our first person experience in each moment. And from that side, from the subjective side, consciousness is the one thing in this universe that you can't actually be in doubt about. I mean, you could be confused about every other thing. You might be a brain in a vat. You might be asleep and dreaming right now. You might be in the Matrix. You know, you know, our physics could be not at all in touch with any kind of base layer of reality. We could be wrong about everything, but the one thing you can't be wrong about is that something seems to be happening from your point of view, right? Like the lights are on in some way, you know, whatever the status of this experience is, there's something that it's like to be you. And that's the fact of consciousness in your own case. That's what we mean by consciousness. And if you know, when you die, you lose all that, well, then that's to say that, you know, consciousness actually ends at death. You know, if something persists after death, if the lights stay, if you, everything could change, but if the lights stay on in some way, well, then that's synonymous with saying that consciousness persists after death. So from the first person side, consciousness is the primary datum, right? And then the question is, what can be discovered about it from the first person side, and what and how can we use third person science and first person introspection to develop a rational picture of what's happening? And you know, there are many neuroscience labs studying things like meditation with tools of neuroimaging, correlating, you know, changes in experience with changes in brain states. And that's a totally valid thing to do. But again, the cash value of all of this is ultimately on the first person side. I mean, you can't actually drop the what it's like to be you part of it, because again, there is simply no evidence of consciousness out in the world. And we know it's possible to have complex human behavior doesn't seem associated with consciousness. And we know that it's possible to lose the capacity to do anything behavioral and to still be conscious. I mean, you can have someone with locked-in syndrome who can't even blink their eyelids. And we know that they're trapped in their bodies at that point. And, you know, they can't signal that they're still awake and experiencing everything. And yet they are. And we know this because, you know, there are people who've had this condition who could blink one eyelid and they managed to signal, you know, and even, I don't know if you know the book, the Butterfly and the Diving Bell.
Right.
You know, or was it the Diving Bell and the Butterfly? I forget the order there, but it's an amazing book that was, you know, blinked into existence by the author who could only move one eyelid. And, you know, but for that, no one would have known that there was the lights were still on. So we know that consciousness is divorceable from any external sign of it.
Well, there would have been brain activity though, right? Like they could have hooked him up and seen the actual active brain activity.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Again, the correlation there is totally interesting and valid. And, you know, I think at some point we will arrive at what we have good reason to believe are the so-called neural correlates of consciousness. But again, the correlation game only makes sense if you maintain both sides of the coin. It's like, you know, I mean, you take something like for which there is a clearer correlation. I mean, we know something about, I don't know, the auditory voices that schizophrenics hear, right? So we know if you bring a schizophrenic into the lab and scan their brain while they're claiming to hear voices, you'll actually see activity in auditory cortex that makes plausible sense of this claim. And so it's nice that supports our view of what is in fact auditory cortex, and it seems to support the claim that they're actually hearing voices. But if those two things broke apart, you know, if all the schizophrenics said, well, actually, no, I'm hearing voices now, and now was a point where there was no activity in auditory cortex, the activity was somewhere else. And when there was activity in auditory cortex, they claimed to hear nothing. Well, then our model would change. I mean, then we would say, you know, then we would, you know, auditory cortex wouldn't be auditory cortex in quite the same way, which is just to say that the cash value is always what the person is actually experiencing and their ability to report it to us. It's not to say that no one can be confused about their experience in any way, but, and that obviously people can lie about their experience, but it's the idea that we ever get rid of this subjective side of the coin is actually an illusion. And there are many scientists who are taken in by this and who think that, you know, ultimately we'll just talk about neurotransmitters and neurophysiology and drop the language of thoughts and desires and intentions and emotions. And it can't be true. I mean, it's just because it's the only way we're finding those neural correlates is by correlating them with the actual experiences that people are reporting.
And then how does this tie back into meditation? Like how does a practice view consciousness in meditation?
Well, so introspection was fairly stillborn in the West. I mean, about 150 years ago, there were psychologists who were trying to bring it into some scientific methodology. And you had people like William James who were giving it a go, but it became a kind of dead end. And this was largely due to the fact that they just didn't have the methods to, you know, pay sustained attention to experience. I mean, everyone was lost in thought all the time and never saw an alternative. Whereas in the East, you have very sophisticated methods of meditation, but they're arising in a cultural context that didn't have a rational scientific picture of the world. I mean, they were arising in explicitly religious cultures, you know, in Buddhist and you know, Indian, you know, now nominally Hindu. And so the interpretation of the data of experience didn't yield a scientific picture of reality, but it's just a fact that you can train the mind to be a much better observer of itself, and you can notice things about the nature of consciousness and about the nature of your mind that are totally in harmony with what we have every reason to expect based on how we study the mind in psychological science and in neuroscience and certainly what we know about the nature of the brain. So you can bring your experience into closer conformity with a 21st century picture of what the mind should be like. And I mean, for instance, you know, there's just no place in the brain for an ego, an unchanging self, to be sitting, right? I mean, that's just not what's happening in there. It's not what's happening structurally, and it's not what's happening physiologically, right? I mean, the brain is in terms of what's actually happening that is giving rise to your experience, it's a process. I mean, you're much more of a verb than a noun. And the idea that you are the same self that, you know, went to sleep last night and then woke up this morning, and that you've got this unchanging center of narrative gravity that just passes through moment to moment, that's a construct that doesn't actually have a correlate in the brain. I mean, there's no way to make sense of that idea. And because this sense of self has got to be a process on some level, it totally makes sense that that process can be interrupted. Right. And you can experience this directly yourself. And I mean, there's an analogy I sometimes use for this, which is another place where you can see how like a prediction from the third person anatomical side indicates a possible experience that then people can confirm. And this is the experience of seeing your optic blind spot. You know, so most people in human history didn't know anything about the blind spot. Then we started learning something about the structure of the retina of the eye. And we noticed, well, wait a minute, you got the optic nerve transiting through the retina. And in that spot, there are no photoreceptors. There has to be a spot in the visual field where you're not seeing anything in each eye, because it would be a miracle if you were getting data from that spot, because there are no photoreceptors. And, you know, lo and behold, you can actually run the experiment. You can close one eye and look at, you know, stare at a fixation cross on a piece of paper and draw a mark, you know, elsewhere on that paper. And you can move the paper into a spot where that mark, you know, the other mark you've drawn will disappear. And, you know, most people wind up doing this in school at some point and then forgetting about it for the rest of their lives. But that reveals that you can look at something, in this case, about the anatomy of the eye, and predict something that must be true of your experience if you could only pay careful enough attention to it. And there's an analogous thing that is true about the self, which is you look at the brain and you realize, well, this is not a place where there's going to be an unchanging me that just rides around, you know, that just like bobs like a cork on the ocean of experience for, you know, 75, 80, 90 years. So is, this, is there some way of viewing my experience moment to moment that's more in register with what we would expect it to be based on the third person facts? And it is in fact true to say that there is. I mean, you can actually notice that when you pay very close attention to the way consciousness is in each moment, the sense of self drops away, and that there is no center to consciousness. There's no subject interior to the body. I mean, this is one of the strange paradoxes we have, is that we, most of us don't feel identical to our bodies. I mean, you might just believe that, you know, of course you're your body, you're your brain, you're the totality there. I mean, that's you, the person. But most people are walking around feeling like they're passengers in their bodies, that are like a kind of vehicle. I mean, they're kind of common sense dualists, where they think they've got a mind that is in their head, and you know they're riding around in the body. And then when you tell them to meditate, and you give them an object of meditation like the breath, well, then they kind of feel like they're above the breath, and they're aiming their attention down at it. And, you know, hopefully getting closer and closer to it, and then they get lost in thought, and then they come back to the breath. But they feel like a subject in the head. And if you pay close enough attention to it, actually disappears. And that does, it, from the neurological side, it makes sense that it would, because it just can't be the structure of things.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, exercises that I thought was so powerful that you had in the app, and I can't remember if it was a lesson. I think it was a lesson where you look in the mirror and try and find the seer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that for a minute, that practice?
That was somewhat inspired by Douglas Harding's teaching that first appeared in his book titled On Having No Head. And so Douglas Harding was this English architect who kind of stumbled on, he was a Zen student at first, but he kind of stumbled on his own way of articulating the insight here. And he was wandering around outside of Kathmandu, a place called Nagarkot, where it has a great view of the Himalayas. And he was looking at the mountains, and on his account, suddenly realized that he had no head, that he was just where his head was supposed to be. There's just the sky and the mountains and, you know, just this vast expanse. I mean, it was just the world in place of where he knew his head should be. And then the exercise he gives people is to look for their heads as you gaze out on the world. Look for the thing you think you're looking out of. You know, try to turn attention upon itself, and you might discover the moment you try to do that. For that moment, there really is just the world, and you're no longer separate from it subjectively. He then, being an architect, he created a bunch of clever exercises by which to interrogate this experience. And, you know, one is to notice that when you're talking to another person, or indeed when you're looking at yourself in a mirror, there are not two heads there. There's just one, right? You don't, you know, when you look in the mirror, the only head you see is the only face you see is the one in the mirror. And you, as a matter of direct experience, are simply this open space in which that head is appearing. And that can kind of shift things for people, where they just suddenly notice that, yeah, consciousness is just this wide open, undefined condition in which anything that can be noticed is noticed. And that's true for everything, you know, inside and out. It's true for what you notice out in the visual world is true of your sensations, internal to the body, is true of your thoughts. People think that there's two places. They think that when they're meditating, right, with their eyes closed, they're sort of in themselves, in their heads, you know, paying attention to what it's like to be them. And then they open their eyes, and then the world comes rushing in, and they're, you know, and so the boundary between self and world is drawn at the skin in terms of their experience. Now, again, from the third person side, it's fine to talk about, you know, people in the world, and, you know, what's inside your skin is you for the moment, and what's outside your skin isn't. I mean, that's fine. But as a matter of experience, what you're calling the world is just as much inside consciousness, inside your brain, if you like, as anything else you're noticing. I mean, you can notice this if you look at your visual field, and then just imagine, just visualize something with your eyes open, and superimpose it on your visual field. And so, let's say you're staring at your computer right now, and just, you know, briefly flash an image of, I don't know, the Eiffel Tower, or Oprah Winfrey, or a chariot, right? I mean, these things are, like, depending on how clearly you can visualize things, this could be, you know, more or less distinct. But for most people, something will be superimposed there as though seen with the open eyes. I mean, it's kind of the same space in which you're seeing the quote, real world. And I mean, there's no other space for this to happen in. I mean, you have one brain that is delivering you, you know, every facet of your experience in this moment. And so what's happening in our waking life is very much analogous to what's happening when we dream. It's much more constrained by sensory inputs when we're awake than when we're dreaming. But it is a kind of vision, you know, or a kind of user interface where we're always in the same condition, and the condition from the first person side is always a matter of experiencing consciousness and its contents. And so meditation just becomes a way of recognizing what consciousness is always already like in the midst of that. And that becomes an immensely empowering thing to do, because then you can break the connection to so much psychological suffering. I mean, whether it's, you know, all possible psychological suffering, you know, I can't say, but when you look at the mechanics of your own suffering, when you look at why you become anxious or afraid or self-hating or, you know, anything, you know, ashamed, it is a matter of being identified with a thought, or, you know, something arises in your mind that you just don't inspect, you don't notice, it seems like you, you know, and it's a voice in the head, you know, or an image, or you know, you're reading, you can be reading something from the physical world, you know, the look on another person's face, you know, you read that back onto yourself, and you're captured, attention is captured in that moment, and everything closes down into whatever the emotional or behavioral contents of those thoughts and judgments and reactions seem to be. And it's very similar to being, you know, asleep and dreaming and not knowing that you're dreaming, you know, and then the difference between a normal dream and a lucid dream is fairly impressive. And certainly the difference between being asleep and dreaming and waking up and realizing you were safe in your bed that whole time is fairly stark. And there's something about breaking the spell of being lost in thought with real mindfulness that is analogously freeing. You just are no, for that moment at least, you're not taken in by the thing that otherwise would have totally determined your state of being for, you know, moments, minutes, hours, depending on how long you got on the ride and couldn't see any alternative for.
Yeah, it's just, I think when you first start to practice or have a dedicated practice over time, and you start to see these little tiny cracks or little breaks where you're like, wow, I would have not done it that way previous to practicing. It really is a shame that it takes quite a while to kind of get there. I think that one of the reasons why I really appreciate that yours is a 50-day course is there's like a rush to the who can do the quickest meditation. You know, I saw a meditation out the other day that was out there that was like 5-minute meditations, you know, and it's going to be 1 minute or right. I feel that you need to give it time to actually see some of these real benefits to shine through.
Yeah. I mean, certainly for most people, it takes some training. I mean, it's a skill, you know, it's like anything else. You'll experience that you're not good at it in the beginning because you haven't trained this at all. I mean, this is running against the grain of everything you've been doing with your mind for your entire life, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's just not, you know, it's like riding a unicycle or playing the piano or something that you just have never done until you've attempted to do it. And the first attempt can seem like just a stark failure, which in most cases it is. I mean, in most cases, people who attempt to meditate and for the longest time may think they are successfully meditating, you know, they've just closed their eyes and they're thinking with their eyes closed, right? They don't have enough concentration to even notice how distracted they are. You know, they may just come away thinking, oh, that was kind of pleasant, but you know, they were just thinking the whole time. And so one of the virtues of an app is that it's actually the perfect technology to interrupt that. I mean, all you need is an audio track that is a kind of mindfulness alarm that goes off that tells you, that reminds you that you should be meditating. And that can be, it can be very helpful even for very experienced meditators. I mean, even for the most experienced meditators, they're going to be more mindful having someone occasionally tap them on the shoulder saying, hey, are you paying attention? And so it never, until you're totally stabilized, it seems always useful to me. But it's, in the beginning, it can be very frustrating. And what you have to realize about the beginning is the practice really is just, you know, endlessly noticing that you're distracted and just coming back to the practice, you know, coming in the beginning, coming back to noticing the breath or sounds or sensations in the body. And that willingness to come back without judgment. I mean, judgment is just another thought that's capturing you. You know, frustration is another thought that's capturing you in that moment. So there's only one remedy ever, which is to just notice that and drop back and be aware of the next thing that appears, whether it's a sound or a sensation or a thought.
What are your thoughts on enlightenment? I know that that's like the, you know, obviously anyone talks about, it's almost used as like a slang word these days, you know, it's like the hot thing or what's, you know, what is it? How does one obtain it? And then I know that you've had some mixed feelings, or at least I've read that you've had on whether it's actually a lasting feeling or is it something that just arises from time to time?
Well, I have no reason to believe that it's not possible. And what I think it would be just a full stabilization of this insight into the non-duality of awareness. Just that there's just awareness and its contents, and there's no subject in the middle of it all. And on some level, the contents of consciousness are unified with it. I mean, they're kind of an expression of it. It's like waves on the ocean. It's not like you have the ocean on one side and the waves on the other. The waves themselves are you know, a modification of this underlying reality, which is the ocean. And that's the way it feels in consciousness when you're recognizing the non-duality of subject and object, when you're simply just seeing and hearing and even thinking without this sense of subject-object dualism. And the fact that you can experience that for 2 seconds makes me think that you can experience it for 2 minutes and 2 hours. And, you know, why would you ever overlook it again if you could get to the point of that kind of stability? And I've certainly met people who have been extraordinarily good advertisements for what it might be like to be very stable in this intuition, right? I mean, I've met people who've spent decades on retreat doing nothing but pay attention to this and come out, you know, extremely, you know, wise and radiantly good-natured as a result. Of course, we all know there's, you know, horror stories of gurus mistreating their students and having, you know, feet of clay or worse. And I think on some level that, I mean, that demands an explanation. I mean, I think in most cases, these are not purely conscious frauds. These are people who really did have genuine insights and real experience. It's just they weren't stable in it and they were still susceptible to you know, all of the normal human failings of greed and narcissism. And there really is no circumstance where you can more fully exploit your egocentric desires, however transitory they are, than being a guru. I mean, it's like the ultimate rock star experience, especially in a traditional context where you're getting this sort of Eastern authoritarian, you know, very hierarchical structure imposed on the relationship between teacher and disciple.
You've seen the Osho documentary, I take it.
Yeah, yeah. So Osho was a great example of this. So, you know, Osho was very smart. I have no doubt that he had experiences of the sort that he was describing. And so it's like he knows what, you know, if he were around and listening to our conversation, he knows what I'm talking about now when I talk about the nature of consciousness. But he was also a guy who, you know, clearly just, you know, couldn't resist, you know, screwing all of his, you know, pretty female students. And I mean, the guy was a madman, right? I mean,
what was the name of the documentary? Some Wild West
Wild, Wild Country.
Well, yeah.
I mean, there are even crazier facts about Osho that I don't think showed up in that documentary, but he was really out there. I mean, he was, you know, snorting nitrous oxide and getting a blowjob every 45 minutes. And I mean, he was really just, he had a,
he was living up the guru life.
He just went all in. You know, a clever skeptic asked him, you know, why is it, Osho, that you seem to be surrounded, you know, only by large-breasted women? I mean, like of all the, you know, you pretend to be fully enlightened, and yet, strangely, you know, all the women in your retinue are attractive and have large breasts. And he says something like, you know, I have been tyrannized by small-breasted women for many lifetimes in succession, and I'm not going to put up with it in this lifetime. So it's like once you cross over and are, you know, totally unimpeachable, you know, even when you're buying the 93rd Rolls Royce or whatever it was, you're surrounded by a culture of sycophants but again, it's somewhat paradoxical because you're also giving actually valid teachings to people who are having mm-hmm. real peak experiences in your company. It's not like everyone was lying, right? I mean, they're all, you know, they're a lot of them are doing real practice and having profound insights that are transformative, and they're, you know, associating those insights with him. And yet, you know, he's clearly a very mixed bag ethically. And there, you know, the numbers of gurus who flame out in this way they outnumber those who don't, you know, at least if I had to bet. So I think it's a relationship that needs a modern rethinking, you know, where a teacher I think you have to just lose the hierarchy and think of a teacher as someone who has a range, has an expertise. I mean, they have more experience in something than you do, and you want to learn this thing, but you know, this is like learning to play the piano or learning to hit a golf ball or, you know, getting a life coach or something that it doesn't have the same component of projection and, you know, transference and countertransference and, you know, the crazy dynamics that really cause people to ignore, you know, starkly unethical behavior or rationalize it.
Yeah, it's crazy how, you know, some of the teachings in Zen, I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of these, where it's like, it's such a shocking act that happens from kind of master to student, that is that moment that kind of like forces them into enlightenment, right?
Yeah.
Or that at least that's what the stories will tell you.
Yeah. And you know, that tradition is generally described as crazy wisdom in the, I mean, that's a kind of a Tibetan framing of it, but the idea that at a certain point, you know, a teacher is so free of self, you know, and certainly a fully enlightened teacher is entirely free of self-concern and grasping and also therefore shame and a capacity to be anxious or afraid, or and then this person can operate in a way that is totally novel and creative and not at all constrained by normal cultural norms and taboos, and therefore this person is free to break all of the taboos all of the time if it's an expression of wisdom and compassion and can skillfully, you know, wake people up to their true nature. And so that's the kind of the ideological underpinnings of it. And, you know, it might in fact be true in some cases or in certain moments. I mean, there's no reason why it couldn't be true. But what I've seen in practice is that it only seems to be true in the literature. It doesn't seem to be true in real life when you have to spend time around these teachers and they're behaving like lunatics, right? And it also just seems like it's not an accident that all of this taboo breaking and chaos tends to run in the direction of having a teacher, usually a man, gratify his all too predictable desires. Right. I mean, it's not especially crazy wisdom if, you know, this man simply just wants to sleep with the prettiest wives of his students. Right. You know, like, well, it would be crazy if he was doing something far less predictable than that. But it often doesn't surprise you what happens under the aegis of crazy wisdom. But again, it's not impossible, because, and this is why it's always somewhat paradoxical and difficult to argue against, because it is in fact true. Like, you know, if your guru wants to sleep with your girlfriend or your wife, you know, if you're a man, you know, why do you find that threatening? You know, why, you know, let's put the onus on you. What's the problem with that? I mean, don't you want her to be fully enlightened? And don't you see that it's all about, you know, there really is no zero-sum contest between, you know, her being happy and delighted. And
it's just your attachment to a physical object. And
it's just your attachment. It's just your hangups. It's just your self-concern and your jealousy and your own. And so putting the onus on you, the imperfectly enlightened student, that blow always lands. It's always true, right? And it's true even up to the point of, you know, like, why don't you want me to cut your finger off right now? Well, it's just because you're attached to your fingers, right? Like, you're somebody who you're afraid of pain, and you don't want to go through life with 9 fingers. You want 10, and you had this model of who you're going to be in the future, and now you don't want to relinquish it, and you're captured by thought in this moment. You're not free. You're not resilient enough to just open to this next moment where you're going to feel, you know, this transitory, albeit excruciating pain. And then you'll be without a finger, right? But you don't think you can be happy with 9 fingers? Is that really the limitation of your practice? The Zen master or the, you know, the Tibetan Lama or the Hindu guru could always take that line with you, and it would always be true. But I would argue it would also be unnecessary, right? Like, there's no need for true wisdom and compassion to ever be communicated in that way, right? There's another way to get through to people, which is to actually just give them a clear description of the nature of consciousness. And if you really have their best interests at heart, to communicate, you know, as compassionately and honestly and patiently as possible these truths, and to give them a practice that helps them uncover it. And so I just don't see, you know, even if you could say that, yes, it's true that people are only suffering on the basis of their own attachment and egocentricity, and you know, it's possible for some norm breaking juggernaut of a guru to behave in all kinds of surprising ways and have that be an expression of enlightenment. It's still just in the general case, it just never seems necessary. And it always seems to signal something on the teacher side that is a little fishy.
Maybe it's just brilliant marketing. Like, it's a good story, right?
Again, when you look at the mechanics of your own suffering, it's true though. I mean, it is like, you can experience states of meditation where extreme pain and extreme pleasure are equalized, where you just like, you can't even tell whether it's pain or pleasure anymore. It's just extreme. And, you know, so that, like, there are experiences where the boundaries between what is acceptable and what isn't disappear. I mean, so I'm going to take one example, and to some degree, becoming free in even a conventional sense is a matter of being able to transcend these boundaries. So, for instance, I lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I once had my house infested with deer mice. And, you know, this was at the peak of the hantavirus scare around deer mice. And, you know, I completely panicked. I was just like, oh my God, there's deer mice in my house. And, you know, there are news reports of people dying from hantavirus. And I mean, this is to indicate how bad this was. I called the, the Bureau of Health, you know, somebody from the government to come deal with this problem for me. And the person, you know, I got said, listen, there's nobody who's going to come, you know, from the government to help you here. You're going to have to find some, you know, private contractor to exterminator and some, you know, cleanup person to deal with your mice. But let me just tell you what you should be thinking here. You're tempted to think that there's just some mice in your house. I want you to realize how you would be responding emotionally if you woke up in the morning and walked out into your living room and saw a man there standing with a bloody axe, right? How would you be disposed to respond to your present situation? That's how you should be motivated in this situation. This is going to sound like an abstraction to you. You can't live with deer mice in your house, right? This is before your time, but I think I'm, you know, like 10 years older than you. But this was, you know, I was, I think 25 at this point, 22 maybe, somewhere around there. But this was just, you know, made in national news, what was happening with hantavirus. And the epicenter was in the Four Corners area in the Southwest. And so I wasn't too far from that. And I had the same kind of mice in my house. And it was so bad. So then I found this is a long backstory, but I'm just giving you the context of my mind here. I found a company whose job was to clean up, you know, toxic spills. And even they were the company you would call if you had a dead body. If like they come in after the police to clean up a murder scene, right? And they deal with, like, you know, blood aerosols and, you know, like, you know, HIV aerosolized. I mean, they would come into any, if I had called them and said, listen, I have a headless torso in my basement and, you know, you got to come clean it up, they would have come for that job. And I said to them, listen, I got deer mice in my house. I need someone to come and just clean up my storage room in the basement. And they said, no, there's no price. We're not going to do it. Wow. I said, name your price. And they said, there is no price. We won't do that. Anyway, so this is the this is in my backstory. And some years later, I am on a meditation retreat. And I'm staying in a room. It's like the retreat's full. This is the only room there is for me to stay in. And I go to sleep the first night, and I hear, you know, the pitter patter of little feet around my head, and I switch on a flashlight, and I see, you know, a deer mouse, you know, scurrying away into the closet, and, you know, it takes me a second to figure out what's going on here. I see, you know, droppings. I see little, you know, pieces of paper that they've been eating. And so I have a room that's completely permeable to deer mice and they're now living with me and coming out, you know, the moment I turn off the lights to go to sleep. And this is the first night of a 10-day retreat. And, you know, this is what it's going to be like. And, you know, this, given my experience and given what I just understand about, you know, the risk of, you know, airborne, you know, contact with things like hantavirus. I mean, just breathing the aerosolized urine of deer mice is just not or any rodent is just not a good idea, you know, especially in a confined space. This is not and I'm a bit of a hypochondriac anyway. This is just not the kind of thing I'm disposed to let go of, right? Like this is where you just get up and leave the retreat.
Right.
But the reality is I just wanted to work with this. And, you know, I realized it was just a calculated risk. I mean, what are the chances that I'm going to get hantavirus from these particular mice? I don't know, but it's probably not one in a million, but it's probably not one in 10 either. And so I just decided to let go of it. And the truth is I could absolutely let go of it. You know, like at the most basic level, let go of it so that it was just no longer a problem. Now, that's something that, so it's like, it's kind of a binary choice. You know, it's like, it's the kind of thing that would have bothered me. You know, it would be like, it would be a 10 on the scale of, you know, 1 to 10 in terms of something I just do not want to be dealing with on a moment to moment basis. It's a situation objectively I want to get out of, and yet I could just decide to let go of it. And that's what a teacher who's behaving like a colossal asshole could be trying to show you from an enlightened perspective. It's always possible, and it's always possible to let go of it. I mean, it is possible to just be the guy who said, all right, sleep with my wife. I'm actually fine with that. And to actually be fine with it. I mean, you can actually let go of your jealousy and all of your hangups around that totally at some basic level. But the question is, why is this particular teacher asking you to do that? And, you know, the answer, certainly in most cases, if you follow these, you know, these people's careers long enough, seems to be, well, because they actually were, you know, far too ordinary and just wanted to sleep with everyone in sight. And yet it is a paradox, because it's just a psychological fact that you can transcend these things. And the purpose of meditation ultimately is to have a mind that is that resilient and that can just, I mean, on some level, we're all just getting ready for the worst day of our life, right? You know, we're all getting ready to die. We're all getting ready to be the kind of person who can let go of this life gracefully and to have it all have been beautiful, you know, even in the end. And, you know, either that's possible or it isn't. And it certainly seems to be possible. Yeah. But if that's possible, you know, you want to be embracing that more and more in every moment. And it's certainly possible to have a teacher who would make, you know, fairly unconventional demands on you or seem to make those demands to get you to realize that. And so that's why this is always a somewhat paradoxical thing to evaluate.
Yeah. One of the things that, I remember being a teenager and was kind of pulled into wanting to learn more about just meditation and monks in general. There were monks always had this kind of like cool factor. I don't know, at least where I was growing up, but, there was a album cover on Rage Against the Machine, which was like a kind of a, not indie band, but you know, a kind of metal rock style. I don't even know what genre you'd categorize them as, but I don't know if you remember this cover, but it was a Vietnamese Buddhist monk who was protesting. Oh, yeah. Do you remember this cover?
Yeah.
And there actually is, a bunch of photographs of this monk sitting down. They were being gasoline poured on top of him, sitting in lotus posture. And then another monk, or handing him a, I don't know if it was a lighter or what it was, matches. He lit himself on fire and didn't say a word, just engulfed in flames, and eventually tipped over and burned out. No pain, no screaming, no nothing. How is that even possible?
Yeah, well, it's not surprising that it's possible. It obviously takes a lot of equanimity to be able to deal with that kind of, you know, what is undoubtedly the most intense sensory experience on offer,
yeah.
You know, burning alive, and to not flinch. It is, I mean, it points to a, on some level, the promise of meditation practice and an underlying truth about the nature of consciousness, which is it's possible to recognize that consciousness transcends its contents in some basic sense, so that you're that which is aware of an unpleasant sensation or emotion is exactly the same thing as that which is aware of a pleasant one. And it's not actually, it doesn't actually take the shape of what it knows, or at least it supersedes or transcends what it knows. And therefore it's free of it in some basic sense. I mean, you can fall back into this position of merely witnessing experience so much and so resolutely that, yeah, you can make, there can be an immense amount of space around even very unpleasant experience. And that's it's quite a refuge to find, because then you can be equanimous even with, you know, intense states of sadness or intense physical pain. And, you know, there's no question that the sadness and the pain are coming, right? I mean, and the time to train to get better at that, to get more equanimous, to be more flexible is now. You know, it's very hard to get a strong meditation practice in hand when you really need it, right? It's the time to do that is when life is great and, you know, you're not just plunged into any chaos. And then, you know, because again, it's like, this is not hypothetical. You know that if you, no matter how good your life is, you know, forget about physical pain, but let's say we cure physical pain. Maybe there's, you know, someday there's a pain pill that just works perfectly and we don't have to worry about physical pain. I think, you know, that's certainly conceivable. And you know, I hope we live to see it. But there is still the reality that, you know, however long you live, you're going to lose people who are close to you. You know, you're going to lose if you live long enough, you're going to lose everyone, right? So you'll be the last man standing in your life. So you know that dealing with the pain of loss is something that you have to get in hand now. Otherwise, you'll be the mere victim of loss. And so if it's possible to have a mind that can actually, you know, find a state of tranquility, even in the midst of that kind of sadness, which is inevitably going to arise, you know, why not begin to find that now?
Yeah. One of the, it's not as hardcore as gasoline and being lit on fire, but you have a meditation, as one of the first 50, I can't remember what number it was, but it's where you challenge the individual not to move during the entire meditation, even if there's discomfort. Mm. And then looking at that and feeling that discomfort as just an object in consciousness,
yeah,
and examining it that way. And it's crazy how, when you start to examine these things, how they just kind of dissipate in a way.
Yeah. And people who sit retreats often begin to experiment with this, where you're sitting for, you know, longer periods of time. You know, you're sitting for an hour, you're sitting for 2 hours, you can sit, some people sit for much longer than that, and they can vow not to move a muscle for that time. And the amount of pain you can experience, no matter how comfortably you're sitting, if you just wait without moving, is really impressive. What's amazing about it is you can know for sure that it's not a sign that something is wrong with you. I mean, you're not getting injured really, but it sure can feel like you are, right? And it's worth experimenting with, because it really is possible to get surprising degrees of equanimity with that. And it's you know, it's good to practice with, you know, just ordinary levels of pain, you know, an ordinary headache or an ordinary injury. You know, just see if you can really be at peace with it, even just for a few moments before you decide to pop the ibuprofen that you were going to take anyway, just to see what that's like. Because, you know, eventually there are pains that just, you know, that you despite whatever drugs you have on offer, you have to be with to some degree. And the question is, how much time are you going to spend being miserable, and how much time are you going to actually be, you know, free in that, in the presence of that? And so meditation can be very useful there.
100% agree. And Sam, thank you so much for being on the show. And I want to direct people to download your app. I think that, you know, having just finished the 50 days, that for people that are out there that are looking to really take meditation seriously, you know, I know we've talked about that before, but I worry that there are other products out there that I'm sure are doing great in terms of reducing anxiety. And, you know, if you have very prescriptive needs, they probably have the content for you. But I really love how you're actually, I feel like, really teaching people to build a real respectable practice. And the lessons are phenomenal. You have a great section of, gosh, we probably have a couple dozen lessons now, right?
Yeah, I think there's like 40 or so. And we're actually restructuring the app in this next build, where, because I'm bringing on conversations with other teachers and other kinds of content, and even some other teachers' content as well. So it's always under development. As you know, with an app, it's never done. So yeah, we're continually expanding it. But it's generally speaking, there's the meditation track, which has, you know, this introductory course, and then, you know, after that, a daily meditation that keeps changing. And then there's a kind of a theory section that has lessons and conversations and more discursive instructional content. And yeah, it's continuing to grow, but I'm really, really happy you found it useful.
Yeah. And once you get past the 50 days, you go into a daily meditation that refreshes every day. I've seen that. I just checked it out immediately after I finished my session today, because I didn't have access yet. Actually, I have to unlock it after the 50 days. It appears to be a 10-minute meditation. When do you recommend that people spend more time meditating, like going even deeper?
Yeah, well, you can toggle between 10 and 20. You can set it for 10 or 20, and then it's the same meditation, just with more silence.
Oh, is that in the settings somewhere? For the 20. I didn't see that option.
Yeah, it's in the player. Yeah.
Okay.
Assuming you have a fairly recent build, it's you can just toggle between 10 and 20. It's really, you know, to everyone to their taste. I mean, I view it not so much as a linear relationship between the amount of time you sit and the amount of insight you have. I mean, there's probably some correlation there, but the truth is, it's, you know, it is quality over quantity. And I think that repeating, you know, many times short sessions repeated, I think that's a better formula than just a kind of a longer single session. I mean,
right.
And ultimately you want to erase the boundary between formal practice and the rest of your life. You want to find clear moments of recognition in every kind of ordinary experience, you know, as you're reaching for a door handle, or as you're taking a first step on a staircase, or as you're, you know, starting your car, or like all of these moments can be moments where you clearly cut through to the same kind of mindfulness you experience in the clearest moments in any formal session. And that's the way that you begin to punctuate your ordinary experience with the freedom that you begin to taste in formal practice.
Awesome. Well, Sam, thank you so much. Once again, the app is called Waking Up. You can get it on iOS and Android as well, right?
Yeah, the Android has been a wonkier build, and we're doing a total rebuild of it that should be available in about 3 weeks or so.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Sam. Appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Kevin.
All right, that is it for this episode. But as promised in the beginning of the show, this is a lesson from Sam's course. Hope you enjoy it.
I'd like you to take a moment to think about all the things in this life that you will experience for the last time. Of course, there will come a day when you will die, and then everything will have been done for the last time. But long before you die, you will cease to have certain experiences. Experiences that you surely take for granted now. if you're a parent, when is the last time you will pick up your child or tuck her into bed or read her a story? Our youngest daughter still says aminals instead of animals. And though I'm a stickler for words, I am not correcting her. Each one of those is priceless. Now, thinking in this way lends a poignancy to everything, even to things that you don't like. Again, let's say you're a new parent and you're getting woken up several times a night by your baby. That's brutal. But there will be a last time. And knowing that can change your experience in the moment. There's something sweet even about this experience. It's possible that you will miss this. We do everything a finite number of times. And yet we tend to take even beautiful moments for granted. And the rest of the time, we're just trying to get through stuff. You're just trying to get to the end of whatever experience you're having. Tim Urban, who writes this wonderful blog titled Wait But Why, often touches this topic. He actually publishes a poster which represents 90 years of life in weeks. Each line has 52 squares, and there are 90 lines on a single page. And the scale is, frankly, a little alarming to contemplate. Each week is a significant piece of 90 years, and you can put your finger on the current week in your life. You can see where you are. And then, of course, you realize you have no assurance of how many weeks you have left. Assuming that you have 90 years, certainly 90 good years, is generally not a safe assumption. What you can know, however, is that each time you do something, pleasant or unpleasant, that is one last time you will do it. And there will come a time when you will have done something the final time. And you will rarely know when that is. For instance, I used to love to ski, and I now haven't skied in well over a decade. Will I ever ski again? I have no idea. But I can assure you that the last time I took off my skis, I was not even dimly aware of the possibility that it might be the last time, right? That I might live for many, many more years, and yet this stood a good chance of being the last time I would ever ski. When is the last time you swam in the ocean or went camping? When is the last time you took a walk just to take a walk? As you go about your day today, consider everything you're doing is like this. Everything represents a finite opportunity to savor your life. On some level, everything is precious. And if it doesn't seem that way, I think you'll find that paying more attention can make it seem that way. Attention really is your true source of wealth, even more than time, right? Because you can waste time being distracted. So this is just to urge you to take a little more care. When you meet someone for the first time and you shake their hand, pay a little more attention. When you thank somebody for something, mean it a little more. Connect with your life. And mindfulness is the tool that allows you to do that. Because the only alternative is to be lost in thought. And every time you notice that you're lost, that you're distracted by a thought about the past or the future, and you come back, you are training your mind. And it may feel like an effort at first, but eventually it's like continually waking up from a dream. And ask yourself, how much effort does that take?
All right, that is it for this podcast. I hope you enjoyed that. I really love that course that that we just listened to. It was one of my favorites. There's probably, at the time of this recording, 30 or 40 different lessons when you sign up for the Waking Up course. And go through those. I think you'll really enjoy them. There's a lot of new things that I'm learning in each of those different little lessons. And he's really done and spent a lot of time creating them. And they're really high quality, as you can tell. So check that out. One thing that you could do to help me out is head on over to the iTunes store or the Apple store. I don't know what they're calling it anymore. Wherever they host the podcast, I think it's within iTunes. Although we just got a new operating system, so maybe they hit it. You know what? I think it's in the podcasting app on Catalina, the new operating system from them. Yeah, it is. It's in the podcasting app. Okay, so go in the podcasting app on macOS and find this podcast, if you would, The Kevin Rose Show, and just give us a 5-star review. That would help us get recommended to more people, get us more downloads, and we'll have even better guests on the show. So thank you so much. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll have more episodes out soon.